Numbers, Chapter 16. The ninth talk in a series on Numbers is presented by David Crabtree on April 7, 2019, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 9, Numbers 16, accompanies this talk.
We're in Numbers chapter 16. This is yet another rebellion, and this is a big rebellion. Just two and three chapters ago, we had the incident where the people refused to go in and take the promised land, go into the promised land as God had told them to do. And in response to that, God said, well, then you aren't going in. Your whole generation is not going in. I'll wait until younger ones grow up and are ready to go in. So that was one of the big rebellions. And as in Jewish history, as the rabbis look back at it, the first one is the golden calf. That's one big event where the people of Israel were rebellious. And the second big one is when they wouldn't go into the promised land. But this one has to be, the one we're going to talk about in chapter 16 has to be just below that, because it's a significant act of rebellion. It's not clear when this happens. We don't have any markers as to the chronology here and how long it was between when they refused to go into the promised land and when this happens. The only thing in between is chapter 15, where some laws are given to them, and there are no indicators there of when that is, how much time has passed. So it could be that we're talking about an event that happens decades later. It's before they go in after the 40 years, but it could be 30 years after they refuse to go in that chapter 16 happens. But it's also possible that it's only 3 or 4 years after the events that are described in 13 and 14 before chapter 16 happens. So we just don't know. We have seen several challenges to Moses' authority, but up to now they've been addressed to Moses. What we're going to see in the next few chapters is there are now challenges to Aaron's authority. And so this is the first in which that takes place. What happens in chapter 16 is complicated, and we have a sparse description of the event. And so I will work through chapter 16, and then at the end, I'm going to come back and try to fill out the picture a little bit. There's some clues that I think make it possible to fill it out a little bit more, and we'll do our best to make it come alive. But it is a complicated event in any case. Chapter 16, first three verses. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, and the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone far enough. For all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord. So we have the names of the people that are involved in this rebellion. It is Korah, who is of the Kohathite clan of the Levites. So he's a Levite of the most privileged of the Levite clans. He's from the Kohath tribe. So he's a Levite, a privileged Levite, and he is one of the leaders. The others are Dathan and Abiram and On, all from the tribe of Reuben. The tribe of Reuben was the firstborn of Jacob. And if we had our chart of where they camped, interestingly, the Kohathites were to the south side of the tabernacle on the inside, and just outside of that was the tribe of Reuben. So they would have camped next to each other, and in all probability, there was a lot of conversation that went back and forth between them in the camp. And Dathan and Abiram are going to be mentioned later in the text, but On is not, and I don't know why that's the case. He is not mentioned later in the chapter, nor is he mentioned anywhere else in the Old Testament. In addition to those four, it says that there are 250 leaders. It says that they are leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. So it's going out of its way to underscore the fact that these are not nobodies. These are prominent individuals that are in alliance with the rebels. Ashley says, these men were not run-of-the-mill Israelites. The text piles up three appositives to show their preeminence. They were leaders of the congregation. They were chosen from the assembly, and they were important men, that is, men of a name. So it's quite a force that has coalesced here in opposition to Moses and Aaron. Now, it's all being presented as if they are united front, but in all likelihood, as we work our way through the chapter, it looks like it's not exactly a united front. They have different concerns. At least there are two different interest groups, at least, represented in this coalition. We've seen that phenomenon before. Remember when Miriam and Aaron rose up against Moses, they seemed to have different concerns, and yet they were united in their opposition against Moses. It's just, I'll just make the observation that historically that is very typically the case, that the easiest way to unite people is in opposition to something. Everybody can agree, I don't like X. If you start to say, what would be better, then everybody diverges. But they can agree, I don't like X. And that seems to be the situation here. They are rebelling against the authority of Moses and Aaron. As we progress, you'll see that one interest group in particular is singling out Aaron. But they are rebelling against both of them. And the complaint that we have listed here by the rebels is, first of all, it says, you have gone far enough. And as I understand it, that Hebrew expression means you have overreached. You have exceeded your boundaries. And the basis for the complaint is all the congregation are holy. Every one of them. And the Lord is in their midst. So what they're pointing out is every Israelite, every single Israelite is holy. So you don't have a special status. and God, Yahweh, is in their midst. He's right here with them just as much as he's with you, is the implication. And therefore, you have no special status that gives you the right to have a position of power over the rest of us. It's interesting that this command is coming here after a section in chapter 15 where they were commanded to wear the tzitzit, the tassels. Because in verse 40 of the previous chapter, it says that they're supposed to wear these tzitzit in order that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy to your God. Now, I don't know that those are related, but they could be related. It could be that now they're wearing the tzitzit, and they every time they see them, they're reminded to do the commandments of God, and they are reminded to be holy to your God, a reminder of their holiness. And it could be that that's something that they have caught on to. I don't know that's necessarily related, but it could be. What Korah in particular seems to be claiming is that Moses and Aaron don't have any basis for their privileged position. Every Israelite is holy. Every Israelite is in the midst, is before God. God is in their midst. And since everybody, in that sense, is equal, then Moses and Aaron have no right to have authority over them. So the solution, as we'll see, the solution is, so give the power to me. It just follows. It is a move that has happened countless times throughout history. That appeal that everybody's really equal. And therefore, those in power have no right for the power that they have. And if you can arouse the people to really hang on to that, yeah, we all should have more power, you can destabilize the power. And once the power is destabilized, then it's easy for someone else to move in and take that power. It's a move that's been done many times, very, very skillfully, especially since the French Revolution. And that seems to be the strategy that Korah is employing here. Next section. When Moses heard this, he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself, even the one whom he will choose. He will bring near to himself. Do this. Take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and bring fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi." So Moses, having heard what Korah has to say and his complaint, Moses falls down on his face once again. Remember, he did that one other time. He did that when the people refused to go into the land. He fell down on his face. And we're going to see that he's going to do that a couple more times. And I suggested last week, I think the significance of that is, I'm not sure exactly what they're thinking, but they're doing this in the presence of outrageous blasphemy. I think it's in recognition that God's going to be here soon, probably in judgment. God's going to be here, and I need to show my obedience to God, my subservience to God, because I'm in the presence of people that aren't. So he falls down on his face before before Korah, and then he speaks, and he's going to speak to Korah in particular. And he says, tomorrow there's going to be a test. There's going to be a way to settle this issue, the issue of who is the one that is holy. And he says, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his, who is holy, and will bring himself, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself. All of these phrases show who is he is his, who is holy, and bring himself and bring him near to himself, whom he will choose. Those are all expressions that are used with respect to the priests. And in this context, that must be what it's talking about. That God is going to settle the issue, who should be a priest before me and serve me as a priest. That's the issue that's going to be settled. And in order to do that, the test that's going to be set up is Korah and his men are all supposed to take censers. A censer that has incense in it and fire. They're all supposed to show up tomorrow with their censers and with incense. And God is going to choose which one is holy, which one is the one that God wants to represent him before the people as a priest. Then he says, you have gone far enough. So Moses turns back the phrase that was used with respect to him, and he says, no, it's you that's gone far enough. It's you that have overreached, you, Korah, in particular. Okay, he has more to say to Korah in verse 8. Then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them? And that he has brought you near, Korah, and all your brothers, sons of Levi, with you? And are you seeking for the priesthood also? Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. But as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him? So Moses clearly sees Korah's, what Korah is asking for, what Korah wants, is he wants to be the priest in the place of Aaron. And he points out that Korah is a Levite, which is a privileged position. The way that God has set it up, to be a Levite is a privileged position in Israeli society, in Israelite society. And God has separated them out for service, service to him, to serve the congregation, to serve in the tabernacle, to stand before the congregation and minister to them. And in particular, the Kohathites are the privileged of the Levites. They're the ones that get to carry the furniture that goes in the tabernacle. So they have the highest status of the Levites, apart from the priests. So he says, and are you seeking for the priesthood also? Are you saying that's not enough for you? Are you saying you want to be a priest also? You want more than what you've got? And he says, therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. That it's against God that you are rebelling, ultimately. Not really against Aaron. Next section. Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, we will not come up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness? But you would also lord it over us? Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. So having addressed Korah, now he turns and he addresses Dathan and Abiram. And he tells them to come before him, appear before him. And I'm sure that he wants to, he has words to say to them. But they say, we won't come. We aren't coming. They are really defiant. They are very rebellious. We aren't coming. And he has several charges against Moses, and these are quite strong charges. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey? So he turns it on its head. God has said that he's going to take him to a land of with flowing with milk and honey. And Dathan and Abiram are saying, you took us out of a land with flowing with milk and honey just to have us die in the desert. Furthermore, it says, but you would also lord it over us. So he's accusing Moses of taking advantage of his position and using his power for his own, his power over the people, abusing his power over the people for his own good. And then they say, it hasn't happened. You said you'd take us to a land flowing with milk and honey. It hasn't happened. And we don't have an inheritance of fields and vineyards. And then this last one, would you put out the eyes of these men? And as I understand it, that Hebrew phrase means, would you pull the wool over these men? So in other words, he's a con man. This has all been a con job from the beginning. Moses is just full of lies. He is deceitful and he is power grabbing. So we will not come up. They refuse to appear before Moses. So that apparently, those guys are representative of the other interest group in here, in this alliance against Moses and Aaron. Verse 15, then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, do not regard their offering. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done harm to any of them. And Moses said to Korah, you and all your company be present before the Lord tomorrow, both you and they along with Aaron. And each of you take his fire pan and put incense on it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 fire pans. Also you and Aaron shall each bring his fire pan. I'll stop there. So at that response from Dathan and Abiram, understandably, Moses is furious. Those are accusations that are completely outrageous. And Moses responds and says to God, don't regard their offering. Now, it's difficult to know exactly what he has in mind here because he uses the word for offering here is mincha, which usually means a meal offering. So it's a very specific kind of offering. That's what it usually means, but there are a couple of instances where it seems to talk in general about that word seems to refer to offerings in general and could be more broadly applied. I don't know exactly what Moses has in mind here, but my suspicion is when he says, do not regard their offering, he's saying, do not accept their sacrifices possibly, or do not accept their whatever it is that they offer to you as a means of establishing connection, relationship with God. So I think he's saying, Don't have anything to do with these people. Don't look kindly on them whatsoever. And Moses defends himself, saying, I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done harm to any of them. So Moses denies the charge that he's been lording it over them. He hasn't taken anything. He hasn't taken any wealth from them, nor has he abused them in any way. So Moses said, you guys show up with your censers tomorrow, all of you, and Aaron and I will do the same, and we'll see how God responds. Verse 18. So they each took his own censer and put fire on it and laid incense on it, and they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Thus Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. So here they are. They're all standing in front of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, I think is the tabernacle. They're all standing in front of the tabernacle, both Moses and Aaron and Korah and all the rebels, and that includes the 250, and they've all got their censers and they're standing there, and the glory of the Lord appears to all of them right there at the tabernacle. Verse 20, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly. So this is similar to what we've seen at least two times, where God is saying, essentially, let me wipe them out. I'll just wipe them out. I'll save you, but I'm wiping out all the rest. And once again, Moses responds as he has responded in the past, and he doesn't want God to do it. But first he falls, they fell on their faces and said, O God, thou God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, wilt thou be angry with the entire congregation? So he's saying, would you kill them all for the sin of the one? There may be two sinners there, or three, or four, 250 some odd, but would you kill them all because of this group, whatever it is? And God acknowledges that appeal. He accepts that appeal. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So God is going to relent. He's not going to wipe out the whole congregation. He says, let's have the congregation step back. And we're just leave the rebels in their tents, at their tents, and everybody else get away. Sounds ominous. Verse 25, then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men and touch nothing that belongs to them, lest you be swept away in all their sin. So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. And Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. If these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. Okay, so Moses says, everybody get away from these tents. Don't even touch them. Implying these are unclean tents. Don't even touch them. Stand back. And so Korah, Dathan and Abiram, they are at their tents. And in particular, it says, and Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. These guys are defiant. They're standing there with their whole families right there in front of their tents, daring Moses to do something. And Moses says, this is how you're going to know that God sent me to do this. I'm not doing this. What's going to happen? I'm not doing it. God is doing it. And here's the way that you'll know, because they are not going to die a normal death. He's going to do something unique here. He's going to do something new here. He's going to have the earth open up, and it's going to swallow them alive down into Sheol. And when that happens, you will know God did it, and he did it because these men have spurned the Lord. Then it came about as he finished speaking all these words that the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, and their households, and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, the earth may swallow us up. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. So the earth just opens up, swallows up these guys, and they are buried alive. Seeing this, the people of Israel, they run back. They're running away. They don't want to be swallowed up by the earth. They're scared to death. But in addition to the earth opening up and swallowing these people, the fire also comes forth from the Lord, and presumably that would mean from the tabernacle. The fire comes out of the tabernacle and it consumes the 250 men that were offering incense. Very similar to what happened, as you will recall, it's just mentioned in Numbers, but it's described in Leviticus, and I talked about it when we came across that mention. But at the time of the dedication of the tabernacle, the two oldest sons of Aaron were offering incense, but they decided to use, they used what's described as strange fire. And I think we know that at the time that the tabernacle was dedicated, fire came forth from the temple and burned up the offering on the altar. I think that they took fire from the altar, and that's the strange fire that they took. But in any case, what happened is they offered incense that in a way that was not authorized. It was with strange fire. And fire came out from the tabernacle and burned the two of them up. So this is very similar here. The same thing is happening. Fire's coming out from before the Lord, from the Lord, and it consumes the 250 men who are offering incense. Verse 36. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, that he shall take up the censers out of the midst of the blaze, for they are holy, and you scatter the burning coals abroad. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered sheets for a plating of the altar, since they did present them before the Lord, and they are holy, and they shall be for a sign to the sons of Israel. So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers, which the men who were burned had offered, and they hammered them out as a plating for the altar, as a reminder to the sons of Israel that no layman who is not of the descendants of Aaron should come near to burn incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his company, just as the Lord had spoken to him through Moses. So Eleazar, who is the oldest living son of Aaron, he, and I'm not sure why he is the one that's selected for this job, but he's supposed to go and collect the censers that the 250 men had used. And it says they are holy because since they did present them before the Lord, and they are holy. So they were used for a holy purpose, and presumably they are therefore still holy. So he is supposed to gather the censers. All of these censers presumably are made of bronze, and they are to be forged into a covering, a plating of the altar. And it doesn't say which altar these are supposed to be a plating for. There are two options. One would be the bronze altar that sits out in front where the animal sacrifices are made. The other altar is the altar of incense that's inside the tabernacle. It's made of gold. I think it has to be that second altar that will be covered with this plating of bronze. And it is a reminder that no layman who is not of the descendants of Aaron should come near to burn incense before the Lord. So this bronze plating on top of the gold altar is a reminder that no layman can offer incense before the Lord. Okay, verse 41. But on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." It came about, however, when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron, that they turned towards the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly." Then they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put in it fire from the altar and lay incense on it. Then bring it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone forth from the Lord, the plague has begun." Then Aaron took it as Moses had spoken and ran into the midst of the assembly. For behold, the plague had begun among the people. So he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he took his stand between the dead and the living, so that the plague was checked. But those who died by the plague were 14,700, besides those who died on account of Korah. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, for the plague had been checked. So this is on the next day. So this is the third day. All of this is happening in a very short period of time. So this is on the very next day, after Korah and Dathan and Abiram and the 250 have been killed. On the next day, the people come and they're grumbling against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." So they're accusing Moses of having killed Korah and his allies, and referring to them as Yahweh's people. And they're accusing Moses and Aaron of having done that. And it sounds like it was a rather menacing situation. It says, it came about, however, when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron. So it sounds like they are very in your face with respect to Moses and Aaron, and probably could have been very ugly, but God intervenes. And they turned towards the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. So God comes and he intervenes and keeps the mob at bay. And then once again, God says to Moses and Aaron, "Get away from among this congregation that I may consume them instantly." So this is the fourth or fifth time that God wants to just wipe them out. And once again, Moses and Aaron respond, well, this time they fell on their faces. So it's in subjection to God. And then Moses says to Aaron to take his, he's supposed to go and get his censer, fire and from the altar and incense, and he's supposed to go out into the congregation to make atonement for them. He's supposed to go out and save them because what's coming is bad. He says, for the wrath has gone forth from the Lord, the plague has begun. So Aaron gets his censer and the incense, he goes out and he stands in the congregation between those who are, have died or are dying and those who have not. And with the incense, he makes atonement for the people. And in so doing, he checks the plague and no more die. So the number that's given of those who died is 14,700. And I've talked before about my concerns about the numbers in numbers, that I don't trust them. I think somehow they got garbled along the ways, but I'm sure that it is a big number. Whatever this number should be, it's a big number of people who died. And that is in addition to those who had died on the previous day, Korah, Abiram, Dathan, and 250 and their families. So a lot of people died in this three-day period because of their wickedness. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, for the plague had been checked. Okay, what I would like to do now is go back and point out a few things about this account that I think are important in trying to visualize what's going on here and why. The complaint of Korah and his followers against Moses and Aaron, in particular Korah, he claims that Moses has too much power. Moses has grabbed power that he shouldn't have. Now, as we've gone through Exodus and Numbers, that seems ridiculous. Moses is not a power-grabbing person. But that's the story that Korah and Abiram and Dathan seem to have told themselves. I think that it is important in this kind of story to remember that the people, the Israelites, they don't have the biblical account that they are reading. They are just experiencing this. And in experiencing this, they can interpret this in other ways, in ways that aren't consistent with the text that we're looking at. So that's what I would like to do, is look at this a little bit through the eyes of the Israelites and how they're experiencing what's going on. I find it very interesting and important to note that Korah, Abiram, and Dathan think that they are faithful Yahwehs. They believe in Yahweh. They aren't advocating worshiping some other god. They're devoted to Yahweh. Korah refers to Yahweh in his complaints twice. And the test that's set up is a test to see who will be Yahweh's priest, who will serve Yahweh. So that is not in dispute. They are Yahwehs. All of the Israelites along the way have seen God's activity. They saw his activity in Egypt when he sent the plagues and when the firstborn were killed, the firstborn of the Egyptians. They saw God's activity when he parted the Red Sea and the Israelites walked through on dry ground. They saw God's activity when the manna was sent and on a daily basis, the manna that was there to gather. They heard God speak on Mount Sinai. They heard him pronounce the Ten Commandments. On a daily basis, they see the cloud and the pillar of fire that go before them. So they've all seen God acting. I think it's highly likely that they are all Yahwehs. They would all see themselves as followers of Yahweh. But throughout this journey through the wilderness, Moses has been an intermediary. Only on Mount Sinai did God speak to them directly. In all other instances, God speaks to Moses, and then Moses comes out and relays that to the people. I suspect that what they're noticing is there is an opportunity there for someone who is nefarious to take advantage of that position. So that it raises in their minds the question of whether what Moses has done has been done accurately and fairly when he's transmitting information from God to them and when he transmits information from them to God. What if Moses has filtered God's messages to his benefit? What if Moses has not advocated for the people of Israel like he should have? Just one example of what I'm thinking could be in their minds is when God told them to go in, was that message which came from Moses to them, was that message complete and accurate? And then when God is displeased when they don't go in, does Moses explain why they don't go in? Because there's a good reason why they don't go in, because the people are really big and the cities are fortified and they're just not up to it. Has Moses been faithful in being the mediator between God and the Israelites? And I think they're suggesting, no, he hasn't. From their perspective, I suspect they're thinking, we were never all that bad, and if Moses had advocated for us as he should have, we would have been fine. So I think my guess is that's the perspective that they're presenting. That's the perspective that they stand for. That's what they think has happened. And I think they've convinced themselves that that's happened. It's important, I think, to remember this dynamic, because I've noticed this in the prophets. If you don't keep this in mind in the prophets, there are some things that are hard to make sense of. When the prophets come to the Israelites, they come speaking for God, but those same Israelites are hearing other prophets saying other things. There are false prophets in their midst also, and they are saying very different things. So the Israelites are in a situation where they have to sort out, who do we believe? Do we believe Jeremiah, or do we believe Hananiah? And this is a situation where the people are faced with the question, do we trust Moses and what he says, or do we trust Korah and Abiram and Dathan? Who is accurately representing the way things are? And apparently then, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram are taking the position that had they been in positions of leadership, things would have been better. Korah should have the power of the priesthood instead of Aaron. And Dathan and Abiram should have political power. Then things would go well. Please note that these rebels had a large following. They must have had a large following. Because even after they are all killed on the second day, on the third day, a bunch of people come and assault Moses and Aaron saying, you killed them. So there must have been a large following. And it is interesting that there must have been an overwhelming denial of the Israelites' own culpability and wickedness that they have demonstrated over the last number of chapters. This rebellion comes just two chapters after the Israelites refuse to go in to take the land and are told that they will die in the wilderness. And they haven't faced into that at all. They've explained it away. We don't know how much time has passed between the two, but they haven't dealt with it. And we're going to see that, Okay. The persistence of their insubordination with respect to God is quite breathtaking in these chapters, and we're going to see even more. It just keeps coming. And it doesn't matter what God does, it just keeps coming. And I am struck by remembering that early in Exodus, Moses was a grown man, but still living in the house of Pharaoh. And he goes out to help his people, if you'll recall. And he sees an Egyptian beating up on a Hebrew slave. And Moses ends up killing that Egyptian. But the next day, Moses sees two Israelites fighting among themselves, and Moses comes to intervene and break up the fight. And one of them turns to him and says, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us?" It was that jab that caused Moses to not want to go back and lead the Israelites. God comes to him 40 years later when he's in Midian, in the desert, and wants him to go back and lead his people out of Egypt, and Moses doesn't want to go. And I'm convinced he doesn't want to go because he knows he's going to get this kind of stuff. All he's going to get is insubordination from the people of Israel. And now we're a number of chapters later, and all he's gotten from the people of Israel is that insubordination. It's truly amazing. Okay, questions, comments?
Thanks, David. When Dathan says that you brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey, do you think he means you brought us out of Egypt? You're the reason we can't enter Canaan? Or is he just so deluded that he's making like an irrational claim?
I think that he has Egypt in mind. Because all along, every time they've grumbled, there's been some kind of comment about we were better off in Egypt. So I think he's even taken that a little further. He said, not merely we would be better off in Egypt, but that was the good land. That was paradise. And in their minds, they seem to have, that's what they've done with their memories of what Egypt was like. It was actually ideal from their perspective, which is absurd. But human beings are capable of such things.
Do you notice anything that would suggest that the Israelites are in some ways resistant to Moses because he grew up in Pharaoh's household or anything like that, that he's not one of them, and that there's a sense in which not just that they're not in charge, but Moses is an alien in some sense and compared to the rest of them? Is there a sense of that or not?
I hadn't really thought about that. I'm not inclined to think that that is a factor at this point. It was earlier. I think it was earlier. But at this point, I don't think that that's playing into it in particular. They don't like Aaron either. So I don't think that's a key factor.
It seems to me Moses is displayed here as undergoing a change. He's not going, oh, to heck with them. Right? He's,
right.
You take them, Lord.
Right.
They're all yours. I'm done with it.
Right.
None of that's here
He's
now.
He's not doing that.
Now it's, I'm in charge. He said, this is on me. These are my, this is, I am repeating God's words. This is my responsibility. You will listen to me. He sort of steps up and quits feeling sorry for himself and takes his responsibility really seriously to the point where God has faced him with this rebellion and said, Moses, this is the hard part of being a leader. There are people who will deep six this entire project for their own selfish ends. You're going to have to separate them from the rest. And that means someone's going to die. So you go down and you tell them what I'm going to do to them. And don't apologize. I mean, this is really different. At least I listen to this.
Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, I need to think about that. Is there a difference in the way that Moses is relating to his people than there has been previous to this? I wasn't thinking that I was seeing anything that was a significant change, but we are coming up to an event in which Moses does do things a little differently, and God calls him out on that. It's a significant event. So are we building up towards that? Is there something happening in Moses' thinking that we get inklings of already? And I'll have to look at that. I'll consider that.
And it seems like the people are conflating God's authority and Moses' authority, because they're saying, you did this, as if Moses could command the earth to open up and fire to come down from
God. It's absurd, right? It's absurd.
There's a lot happening here in these few verses. And one of the questions I have is when he tells Aaron to go grab a censer and some incense and go make atonement for them. Here we see the use of the word of atonement with no blood, no sacrifice, no ritual.
Right.
It's just run out there sort of symbolically and be seen on God's side. And then it divides the dying from those who will live in the plague. But it uses the word atonement.
And we've seen that word used before. That word was used at Mount Sinai when Moses said, the second time he goes to God to try to get God to relent after the incident with the golden calf, Moses says, perhaps I can get atonement for the people. And again, there's no blood, no nothing there either. So it's just getting, it's getting forgiveness, it's getting a pardon in that context. And I think it's similar here, but the censer is attached with that. And I think that the censer becomes a symbol of prayer, of the prayer, the prayers of the priest, essentially. So I think that's the symbolism that's going on here.
I think the idea is really interesting that you threw out that the argument that's being put forward is all the people are holy. So what does Moses think he's doing, lording over them?
Yeah.
Do you think on the third day when the people come out and say, you've killed some of God's holy ones or whatever it is they say there. Do you think that that's an indication of the extent to which that idea has taken hold, that they've essentially become martyrs for this kind of cause that they've started?
Yeah, interesting. That's interesting. He says God, Yahweh's people is the term that's used, that they've killed Yahweh's people. I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting, and I need to think about that some more. But clearly, whatever perspective they were promulgating, it took root. There were a lot of people that embraced that. And we can see as the text, as we go on in Numbers, it's hard to have them back off from that. They're holding on to it one way or another. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that before, when God has said, "I'm going to wipe them out," Moses has had to make arguments saying, maybe you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
This one, he has to make the argument, he makes an argument, and then he's got to act quick, because it's Aaron, get your censer and get out there. It's interesting, he's he can't just be saying, "Oh, don't do it, God." He's got to act. He's got to do something to stop that from happening.
Right.
And it's also interesting that this is maybe the first time that the children of Israel have seen him, in the act of interceding for them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're seeing Moses bows down, but then Aaron's the one that runs out with the censer
But I'm just thinking that before, up on the mountain when God's like, "I'm going to wipe them out," they've got no clue he's done that. So.
Right, and that's part of as I was thinking about this chapter, there's a lot that we know that the Israelites don't have direct knowledge of. And that's where I think is the possibility for Korah and Dathan and Abiram to do some mischief.
It just like you were saying before, to really see it from Israel's side, when I think even of a congregation, when there is dissension, there are so many rumors, nobody knows what's going on.
Right.
And these people, there was hundreds of thousands of them. And many of them did not see this stuff happening firsthand and maybe didn't even know what Moses looked like. When I think of the Israelite side of it, it's a lot to deal with and to really have a firsthand knowledge of what's happening.
Right. Okay. All right, thanks.